Septia Radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think. Artefacto, un espacio radial sobre la cultura de nuestros días, desde una mirada hispanoamericana.
Literatura,
arte,
cine,
teatro,
filosofía.
...60 minutos de crítica cultural para una gran minoría.
Qué maravilla escuchar el acento colombiano. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the British Library. It is a pleasure and an honor to have Héctor Abad with us tonight. We would like to thank the Instituto Cervantes for the support of this event. And I would like to introduce our chair for the evening, Juan Peledo, who is a teacher, translator, cultural critic, director of CTR Radio, and the editor of the cultural magazine, Pedro Negro, who will chair tonight's event. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I know it's customary and almost cliche to say that it's an honor and a pleasure to have the guest that you're having, you know, next to you, but definitely it's an honor and a pleasure to have Héctor with us tonight, particularly for me. For me what? I'm a Colombian by birth. So the book that we are going to talk about and concentrate on resonates very much with me in many ways. Colombians are curious people, and Héctor might correct me about this. We are curious because probably we are the country with the worst image in the world. However, we don't want to be that one. We just want to be loved by everybody. We hated the image that we have. And the image that we have now with Netflix and Narcos is getting worse and worse. So there you are. Even children who are 10, 15 years old studying Spanish, they talk to you about Narcos all the time. So it's dreadful. But there are other images of Colombia, and they are good and bad. Héctor is a writer and is one of the best known writers in Colombia and also in Latin America. This book, which is a remarkable book, has been translated to 12 languages so far. But the importance of this book is that it works at many, many levels. And it works at the level of the testimonial evidence of Héctor and his family and the tragedy. But also, it's a story of Colombia as a whole. It's a story of a city, Medellin, which is a very important cultural city. But Colombia as a country and the mentality of the Colombians and how the big juxtaposition and sort of forces in Colombia operate. So, thank you, Héctor, for being with us. And let me start with the first question, and it's this. Is this a book that was forced upon you by destiny, do you think? That you had to write, do you think? It was impossible for you not to have written this book?
Well, good evening.
Thank you. Sorry about it, just...
I have to think. So, meanwhile, I will say hello to everybody and thank you for coming. I'm happy of being here in London again. This is, I think, my fourth time, maybe fifth. And you are liars. The weather here is always beautiful. Well, I think the other book, the books I have written, all the other books that are not Oblivion, I wrote that those books because I just wanted to imagine stories, to tell stories, to play with words and everything. And probably without the without the fact that my father was killed, I would never mention violence in my books. I would never mention, I would never make violence as a central character of one of my books. I'm not interested in narcos, I'm not interested in, as we say, sicarios, killers, I'm not. I was educated in a very different way at home. I was educated in non-violence in a very simple but happy way. But when violence knock in the door of your house, you have to deal with that. That was difficult for me. It took me almost 20 years. In the beginning, I wanted to forget everything, and then I understood that I had to remember also. And yes, this is for me, this is not a literary exercise, but it's more a very personal exercise for my family, for my kids, for my daughter and my son, and then if it's for more people, that's beautiful. That's beautiful because it's about the memory of a good person.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to write about good people because it's always almost kitsch, almost ridiculous. People prefer bad characters than good characters. But as I took some time thinking and dealing how to do that with distant, dry words, I think it can work better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this distant, dry words is something that I'm going to touch upon. But the second thing, Hector, I mean, you became a writer, but your father used to introduce you as a writer when you were still not a writer. You said it in your book. My father used to say, oh, he's a writer, and you have written some things, but you were not of any substance, as you say there. And your father was a great reader, and you talk about the library in your house. Many European classic books, has to be said, within the European tradition. Was also writing something imposed upon you by a benevolent and very intelligent father?
Yes, maybe there is a very strange destiny in our family. My grandfather began to study medicine, and then his father, my great-grandfather, died of typhus, do you say typhus? Yeah. Probably my father was also upset by typhus because of that. And my grandfather had to go to the farm, the coffee farm of his father, and he didn't finish medicine. So my father, who was not very good dealing with illness and blood and things like that, he took his destiny, the destiny of his father. But he wanted to be a writer, and so I became a writer probably to take his place. And I wanted to be a film director, and my daughter is a film director. So we are postponing our real vocation.
In the terms of the tone that we're talking about, it took 20 years for you to publish the book after the death of your father, about 20 years. And you mentioned how difficult it was at the beginning. There were some attempts, and then you failed because the tone wasn't right. And one of the things which is striking about your book is that it has different narrators. The narration changes. For example, at the beginning, when you talk about as a child, the love that you felt for your father as a child is very childlike. It's lovely in the way you talk about your father. Mm-hmm. But then the book is much more than that. It moves into kind of philosophical discussions about morality, about social justice, about religion, about the politics of Colombia in a very tangential way. Were you aware that you were changing the tone of voice? How was the process in that sense?
Well, the process was also very personal. After my father's assassination, I made probably my only one political speech. I went to the Medellin, I don't know the name of this consejo, the Council of Medellin, I don't know the name. And I made this speech, and in the way out, I was with my mother, and two young men came to us, and their hands were in a bag, in a very suspicious way. And my mother was, she she put herself in front of me and she said, not to him, not to him. So after that, and after that, the person, four people talked in that event, and three of them were killed. And so when the first one was killed, the new president of the Human Rights Committee, I decided to go to Italy. Mm-hmm. I'm answering your question.
I know.
But and I wanted to go to be away of everything. I wanted to become Italian in some ways. I didn't talk about this. I changed the country, language, subject, everything. I had my daughter was 1 year old. I didn't want my daughter to be a sad person. I wanted my daughter to have a childhood like my own childhood, yeah. A very happy one. I wanted to have a happy family far away from Colombia. And I was really, I was disgusted with my own country. I had a discussion with my father. I told him after some terrible events, un país de mierda. This is a
shitty country.
Yes, yeah. And he was very angry. Not a shitty country.
Really?
This country gave us everything. So after many years in Italy, after I began to confuse Italian and Spanish, I decided to go back to Colombia because I wanted to be a writer. Yeah. And being a writer in Italian was, even if I speak well and I have the grammar, okay, is too difficult because I didn't have the language of childhood, the language of a mm-hmm. little yes. boy
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
You don't have that emotion. You don't have the
language of infancy.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I read two books in Italy that I always mention, that are Sequestro un Uomo, If This Is a Man, by Primo Levi. That is a novel that is a... It's also a non-fiction novel that is a testimony
of his yeah.
terrible experience in Auschwitz. And then Natalia Ginzburg, Lessico Familiare, Familiar Lexic, that is a way of telling a story in the language of the family. So I need the language of the family.
And those two books gave you the key for them?
Those books gave me the key, yes. Well, I didn't realize that in the moment. But I began to publish books that were more simple books.
Playful books. Too.
Playful books, that's yeah. the word, yes. Cookbook for sad women.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fragments of loves. Books that... And sometimes I put a chapter, a fiction chapter in those books about a medical doctor who's killed. My editors always told me, but this is not from this book. This is something from someone somewhere. So at the end, I understood that I had to write that book. And as it is chronological, in the beginning it is childish, and then it's less childish.
Yeah. Let's talk about your father a little bit. First, before that, it's quite interesting because the dedicatory to the books, you are dedicating the books to Alberto Aguirre, Carlos Gaviria, survivors.
Yeah.
You're actually dedicated to the people who actually survived, because many of the, you mentioned some of the people who were killed mm-hmm. together with your father mm-hmm. systematically in Colombia for the, not necessarily political views, for the way of seeing society. Because your father in many ways was apolitical, but in a country where everything is read politically, you know, the Manichaean. But let's talk about your father. When you were born, your father was already a prominent figure because your father had a major influence in Colombian society. He was the founder of the, helping to create the school for national medicine. He was an Instituto Bienestar Familiar, the Family Wellbeing Institute. So he was involved in big projects. He also was a diplomat in the United States for a while.
In Mexico.
He was a diplomat in Mexico, but he was also in the United States. For the United Nations,
he worked there for the
World Health Organization. Thank you. So, growing with your father was already a very prominent figure when you were growing up. Were you aware of the dangers that he was involved with? But probably so this happiness that you talk about, your father was very resilient as a person. He used to say how he arrived home and you're having a bad day, he would lock himself in the studio, listen to some classical music, Brahms or whatever, and then come out again fresh and anew and happy and joyful again. Were you aware through your mother's discussions and your older siblings about the role of your father and the dangers?
Our private life was very simple and very happy. We knew that he was, in a way, he was kind of important, but he was a professor in the university and his students loved him very much. He was popular among students, but that was not that important for us. We were not proud of the public figure. Character, mm-hmm. The public figure. Mm-hmm. We were proud of the private one, the father that was so kind, tender, lovely, and that was extra, that was important, but not that important. Yeah. Because he didn't bring much money to the house. So my mother was always complaining about not having enough money. So she opened her
own. He used to give money away too. Your father used to give money away.
Yes, he was all the time. Yes, he was so generous. And so my mother was poor when she was young. So she hated poverty in a terrible way. She didn't. Still, she still is very. She sent me emails with all the bills I have to pay her every month. She's 94, but I have to pay every coin, and sometimes with interest. But she is in the world. She was the real person. She was the man of the house in some ways, in the traditional ways. So, but that is so sad that we didn't realize how in danger he was. Yeah. And that is in the new edition, because in some ways this is a new edition. Mm-hmm. I think I put a small paragraph in, and I say that in some ways we are also guilty. Me, the son, all the family, guilty because we didn't realize how in danger he was. Mm-hmm. And we didn't take him away and tell him, okay, go away, conceal yourself somewhere. But
leave the country.
Leave the country, do
leave
something
somewhere else.
Yes, yes. As Aguirre and Carlos Gaviria, they left the country, they saved their lives.
And they survived, yeah.
And they survived, and they were my readers, but already they are also dead.
Yeah, incredible. But also, the whole thing about your family, the position of your family is a curious one, too. Because although a normal family from Medellin, you were kind of in the center of things. You mentioned, for example, Álvaro Uribe, you know, courting your sister. Álvaro Uribe is a very controversial figure in Colombian politics, former president of Colombia. Also, your mother grew up in the house of the Archbishop of Medellin, which is and it was called the Palace. And your father knew so many people. Your father also was, at some point, a member of the Movimiento Independiente Revolucionario Liberal, the MIRL, that was done by Mikkelsen Uribe.
Yes.
And anybody who knows about politics, probably people know about that. That was a very important political movement, liberal movement, in Colombia in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And many people of importance in Colombia, good and bad, passed through it. So your father was in the middle of things, in other words.
Yes, but probably it was because all my sisters were very intelligent and beautiful.
Yeah.
So many people were around them. Uribe, who became the president, he was behind one of my sisters. And yes, and some rich people, rich people, they like so much beautiful people.
Of course.
So even if we were not of that... They lived in El Poblado, we lived in Laureles, in a different neighborhood.
Okay.
But they came from the rich, they came to see my sisters and to listen to my sisters singing. And so that's why we had this important.
And there was a parade. You mentioned the parade of serenatas. You know,
yeah, many serenatas,
to the windows,
many
like,
serenatas, trying.
You know, old troubadours,
yes,
like that.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes. And one of them commits suicide because of my sister Clara. Yes, it was
incredible. How was it like to live in a house full of women? And you start saying my house was full of women, and you were the only boy.
Yes.
How was that?
It was strange because the nun take us, the six of us, and we take a bath in a big bath tube. All my sisters totally naked, nude. And I was the only one who
was a Jesus-like figure, like Jesus.
I didn't know really why, but they were a little bit different, but I don't know, the nun didn't want they to see what I had.
Yeah.
This strange trilogy. Yes.
And you have a private nun, has to be said. It's a nun who lived with you in the house.
Yes, yes. The nun came.
Yes,
in the bus, plenty of nuns, because the bishop founded a nunnery.
Yeah, yeah.
A nunnery for nuns. Yeah. And these nuns went to very rich families, yeah. But in our case, not. It was free because of the bishop.
Yeah.
So the nun came for free. Yeah. So, but we had this symbol of this status symbol of a nun in the house, but not paying the nun.
But
when they come from El Poblado, from El Poblado and see the nun, they say, "Oh, these are rich people."
Perhaps it's time to talk about religion a little bit, because religion permeates family life and permeated the Colombia at the time. You talk about, for example, this profession. Tell us about. It's very curious because for the Anglo-Saxon public, it would be completely anomalous. This there was a procession created by the Opus Dei of people who were very staunch Catholics, singing and praying the rosary early in the morning.
And you're
talking about 6 o'clock in the morning or something, aren't we? 2,000 people just going around singing and saying prayers. Tell us about that.
In Spain. Franco was still in Spain,
okay.
And they decided to, after, I don't know, there was a virgin who appeared in Portugal, very important, La Virgen de Fátima.
La Virgen de Fátima.
Not Fátima Bhutto, but she appeared to three pastorcitos, how do you say that?
Shepherds, little shepherds, yeah.
Yes, and so they brought the image of this virgin to the countries of Latin America and made the Rosary of Aurora, Rosario de Aurora, I don't know, the Rosary of Dawn. And yes, and they were chanting, and all my sisters and my mother went there, but my father and me, no, we stayed sleeping at home. And the house was divided between the believers
and the non-believers.
And the non-believers.
Yeah.
It was a mix. It was difficult, but yeah, you could sleep more.
But also, curiously, no, you could sleep more. Yeah, good for your health, your mental and physical health. The other thing was one of your father's friends criticized the whole procession, the whole practice of these rosaries and prayers in the morning in a newspaper. And he lost his job immediately.
Yes, he was the dean of architecture
Pontificia University.
Where I was expelled some years after.
It has to be said that Hector shares with Shelley an honor to be expelled from university for writing and pamphlet.
I have a medal.
Against the Pope. The title in Spanish, what was the name of the paper?
Well, the piece was called La Metida de Papa, that is difficult to translate.
La Metida de Papa. Indeed.
Metida de Pata in Spanish is doing something not
correct, yes. And making a major mistake. To mess it up, yes. But Metida de Papa is slightly different. You know. On a more serious tone, for me as a reader, and also sort of kind of skeptical about religious issues and stuff like that, I read it as a sort of, you know that you've got this religious element within you, even if you don't believe, you know what I mean? And for your father, there's a crucial moment in the book with the death of one of your sisters from cancer. And then it changes. And you imply in your book that what happens is that your father, kind of the seal for social change,
became much more obsessed, and he started to be less careful about his own personal safety. And you mentioned something about martyrdom there and selfishness. And they are very interesting, very intelligent sentences about that, which I don't want to read because I don't want to spoil the reading for future readers. But you talk about this thing that your father almost embraced martyrdom at some point after what happened with your sister. Were you aware of these religious elements of your father outside religion?
Yes, religion was central in my family, central in, and it's also very important in the book. Religion was present in every day. My father used to say he was not an atheist, but an agnostic. And a land atheist, he said, because when he was on a plane, he always...
which is a very Latin American and Colombian practice. And clapping when the plane lands. Yeah. Everybody claps. And yes.
He didn't clap, but he did this one. And so he was a land atheist, but not an air atheist.
Yes.
Yes. Ateo de tierra.
Ateo de tierra, yeah. Land atheist, yeah.
And, but... I think we live in a kind of a fantasy. Everything is a fantasy. Religion is a fantasy. But also, if you are materialistic, as probably I am, it's also a fantasy. We really don't know anything. We are small creatures.
Or we replace one creed for another. Yes.
I am a tame atheist. I don't fight with anybody because of religion, because I feel like fighting with my mother. Can I despise my mother for being a believer, or my sisters? No, I respect them very much. I had one time when I was expelled from the university, I was a very, how do you say that?
Militant
atheist.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
And I read this militant atheist from here. I loved him in the period. What's his name? The biologist.
Richard Dawkins.
But now I don't care. Really, I don't care. I don't care if you believe or not. And my mother is more an animist. She's polytheistic. Everybody who dies in the family becomes a saint. And does miracles all the time. So.
Brilliant. Well protected, yeah.
We are totally protected, please. So Marta, my sister is a saint, my father is a saint, so it's okay.
Yeah.
I don't care.
I'm going to ask Hector to read one of the chapters about the families and some of the things. It's brilliant. For me, it's quite humorous. Let's see if you find the humorous too. But it's about daily routines in your house, isn't it? And the religious practices.
It was daily routine in my grandmother's house.
Yes, yeah.
This was difficult because I prefer to be in Well, this is the house of my grandmother, my mother's mother. The house had a chapel and an oratory. And as evening fell, my sisters and I would all sit around grandmother in the oratory, and women would begin to emerge from every corner in the house. Women relatives and women servants and women neighbors, women always dressed in black or dark brown, like cockroaches, mantillas on their heads and rosary beads in hand. The rosary ceremony was presided over by Uncle Luis with his glossy old cassock, stained with ash and worn out with irony, with his raw leper's hands and the tonsure on the white crown of his head. He looked like a giant, at once smiling and furious, both scandalized and in despair at the commonplace sins and incorrigible sinners he had to absolve every evening in the confessional of his apartment. He would wait patiently, smoking one cigarette after another, and singeing, I don't know this word in English, and burning, I suppose, his fingers, repeating over and over his old despairing chant. Oh, when will we get to heaven? Until all the women had arrived from indoors and out. The
there was Marta Castro, who had been consumptive and had been left with a dry, muted, permanent cough and quick, anxious breathing, and who also had one cloudy, bluish, dry eye, because once, while embroidering a chasuble, she had pricked her retina with a needle and had lost her sight in that eye. That was how God had repaid her for doing charitable work for the poor priests, just as he had repaid Uncle Luis himself, who had gone to be chaplain in Agua de Dios, Colombia's leper colony in Cundinamarca, and contracted the disease that would kill him, his back peeling away bit by bit, his fingers coming off in pieces. Once, near the end of his days, my grandmother was making his bed when suddenly, on the sheet, all by itself, she saw his big toe. She ran to call the doctor, but it was already too late, because as well as Hansen's disease, he had developed diabetes, and they had to amputate his legs. First one, then the other. Later, believe it or not, this also happened to Father Lisandro, my grandma's confessor, whose legs had to be amputated after they became gangrenous due to poor circulation caused by diabetes. Both had been struck down from high as punishment from their devotion, Christian zeal and apostolic celibacy. Well before the amputation of his legs, the virus had seemed to Uncle Luis's fingers, eating them away and leaving him with those terrible stamps through which he passed the rosary beads. This part, he chose the part. was one of the most difficult for my mother, because some diseases, you never mention some diseases, especially in some people. Cancer was not mentioned 40 years ago, I remember. And leper, yeah, it was even worse, because it was visible. Mm-hmm. So, in my first fictional book, I mentioned a priest with leper, and it was really a disaster in my family. It was the first time that this was mentioned. And I don't know, I'm sad I mentioned that.
Yes. That's enough. Yes. It's quite lovely, because my next question to you, Hector, was about the difficult aspects of the book, because there are certain aspects, you know, certain passages in the book which are painful to read, and I presume it was painful for you to remember and to try to produce them with, as you say, with distance and with a dry, unsentimental language. Which one do you remember being particularly difficult of all the parts of the books, all the ones that you narrate?
Well, there are many passages. In fact, when I finished the book, I was mentioning that in an interview yesterday. When I finished the first draft of the book, fortunately, I had a prize in Beijing, and I went to China, and I left the manuscript in the hands of my mother and sisters. So they went to the farm all together, and I told them, okay, you read this, you will decide if I can publish the book or not, because it's plenty of private things about your lives and everything.
Did they know that you had written the book already by then? You told them you're writing.
I told them I'm writing about my father.
Okay,
I'm writing about a novel about the day my father was killed. It's not the novel.
Okay.
About that day, that specific day. And I interviewed them, what were you doing that day, that precise hour, minute? Yes. So I went away, far away to China, and I left the manuscript there. But there is a point that I didn't put in the book, or maybe in one draft it was, and is probably the more painful thing that I took away it, and I can mention it now because my sister spoke about that fact, and is that my second sister Clara, after my father's assassination, became totally mad.
Really?
Totally mad. She had to go to the psychiatrist and in treatment for years, I think. So that was was. So Uncle Louis Leper, he was passed away many, yeah, many years before, but I couldn't mention that was the symbol of a destruction of a family, the madness of my sister. Yeah. And so that was so difficult.
Yeah.
I didn't put it, and it is not here, but
talk
about that.
I'm going to talk about something that I asked you before this conversation. Hector, are you okay with what I'm going to talk about? Because it's in your book, and we're going to see the image. We're going to see two images now. And you will see briefly the first one. And it's the moment when Hector and his family go to see the dead body of his father. It's in the book. I want you to see it for
a few moments. No, the photo is not in the book.
No, it's in the book. No, what is in the book is your feelings about at the moment. But what I was really surprised with was your pose. It's just incredible. I remember seeing the photo for the first time and thinking, oh my gosh, you know, and then reading the book and thinking, and there's a part in the book when you express, there's a kind of contained anger there. But the interesting thing about this photo is obviously the anguish of your mother, your sister, your brother-in-law, consoling your sister. But you are kind of distanced. Your pose is quite enigmatic, to say the least. And in your book, you talk about the anger that you felt at that moment. Mm. It's a moment when you start even to swear at people, get out of this F country because they're going to kill you, etc., etc. Get away. You're starting to tell people, look, they're killing me, my dad, because they were killing people at the time. That was one of the few that, you know, were killed. I presume, I'm not going to ask you if you remember so much about it, but when you see this photograph and when you see yourself, do you recognize yourself?
Well, I remember this photo was published in the paper where my father used to write an article every week. I remember they put as the editorial the last article he wrote that he had in an envelope in his office that same day, and it was about violence and how cheap it was to have a killer for $100 to kill somebody. Yeah. So it was cheap killing. Yeah. Imagine was, yeah, very cheap.
And the photo was in the and the worst sicarios, you were mentioning.
The worst sicarios, yes. And the photo was in the first page. In the first moment, we feel, oh, this is an intromission in your intimacy.
Yeah, intimacy. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But in some ways, it's also, then there is a picture I love very much. If you have the occasion to go to El Prado Museum, I recommend you very much to see one of the most beautiful pictures that is from a Dutch painter, like my editors here of World Editions, that I didn't thank for the edition of the new edition of Oblivion. And it's Van der Leyden, Descent of the Cross. And there, the Virgin is desmayada.
Painted
and totally pale. And there are many faces. And I think in the moment of death, there are many, many different reactions.
Yeah.
And I think Van der Leyden discover that in the disciples of Jesus.
Yeah.
And there are faces that are plenty of pain, of horror, of what you think that. There are some previous photos in which, of the same photographer, in which I am desperate, and you can see that, and crying and things. But in that moment, I don't remember exactly the moment, but in that moment I was trying to probably reconstruct myself, and trying to understand what was happening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I wrote a piece that my friend Shorter translated for Granta. That is about a poem that my father had in his pocket, a poem and a list of people that the paramilitaries will kill. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember my hand in the pocket taking out that. Yeah. I said also that my mother took my father's
ring,
mm-hmm. my father Mario's ring. But all these things are written in the book, not because I remembered. Somebody told me, and I kept the journal that I will publish this November. The journal, it's written, but I don't remember. I know it's true because it's written in the journal. And what I was thinking, I don't remember, but I can't imagine that. There is also a phrase by Stendhal, and he says that sometimes sadness and happiness is dry. Sometimes it's plenty of tears, sometimes it's dry. I felt that I was dry.
Yeah. Shall I tell you what I thought? Because I remember seeing the photo before I read the book. Because I was familiar with the photo. I don't know, at some time. But then I read your book. And I went back to the photo later. And what I felt as a reader, I'm thinking about you and what you have written in the book, is that at this moment, you are thinking, it has happened. Something that you were expecting to happen has happened. And I go back to what you mentioned about the title of the book, because we're going to talk about the title of the book. You're mentioning that you took a poem, Staying with Your Father's Blood, which was a poem by Borges, an unpublished poem by Borges, with the list that of the people that the paramilitaries have marked to be killed. Mm-hmm. And of those two survive, and you dedicated the book to those two. But here, it's like you were expecting to happen. Crónica de un asesinato anunciado, almost. For me as a reader, the way that I interpret it is like, at that moment in time, you're thinking, oh gosh, it happened. It's something that you were expecting to happen. There was an anticipation of that moment, was it not?
When that happened, I received a phone call some half an hour before this photo of a journalist who told me, oh, you are okay. I'm happy because they told me that you have been killed. No, I'm okay. And then I put the telephone down and I went to my mother's office and I told her, creo que pasó lo peor. I think the worst has happened.
Okay.
So in some ways I knew, of course I knew, but my mother always said, no, your father, Hector, is so sweet. Hector is so respected.
So loved.
Nobody will touch him.
Yeah.
And we believed that.
Yeah.
No, we knew that he was in danger, but in some ways you believe in the words of your parents. Indeed. It's like a... It's
you
like,
want to believe in the words.
No, you believe. It's something you learn from childhood. Mm-hmm. Yes. You must believe the words of the parents.
We have to clarify, Hector, that the reason why you're telling that is because your father was called Hector Abad Gomez.
Yes.
And obviously you are Hector Abad Faciolince. So, and somebody called you, said, they killed Hector Abad, and they thought it was you. Yes, the kind of
relation. He mentioned the name.
The nation was...
He mentioned the name. He didn't say, somebody told me, you have been killed.
Okay. Let's talk about the title. Because I think, like translation, I think you are... The quality of your Spanish, and that's something I'm going to talk later about that, in the way you write it, the way that I read your Spanish, which I really, really enjoy. I think that it's not, it must be a pleasure to translate you actually in other languages. I would imagine that, and that's the reason why it has been translated into so many languages. But the thing that is lost in translation, it has to be said, is the title of the book. Because the title of the book is El Olvido Que Seremos, The Oblivion That We Will Become, rough translation. In a poem by Borges. Tell us a little bit about how you have to rescue also, not rescue, but prove that poem was by Borges. Mm-hmm. Briefly, I mean, I know it's a kind of long story, but you have to do an investigation because there was all these conflicting stories and there's some apocryphal publications of the poem, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm. Well, the title is always a decision of the publishers.
Yes, I know.
Sorry, Anne McLean Rosalind Harvey, who translated the book, and two good friends after that, and great translators, both of them. They discussed with the publishers in America, FSG, and here, I remember Vikram Seth, a friend of mine, telling me, no, it's possible to translate that as the oblivion we shall be or something like that.
Sure.
But for publishers, it sounds a little bit
too
strange.
Long, yes.
For me, it was clear, was the first line of the poem my father has in his pocket. It was clear after many years. My friend Aguirre, who is dedicated to the book, he always told me that he didn't like the title. He preferred a different title. But I love the title.
Yeah.
In the beginning, it was the whole verse, that is 11 syllables. Ya somos el olvido que seremos. But my publisher in Colombia, Pilar Reyes, suggest me to short the verse to El Olvido Que Seremos.
Yeah.
In titles in Spanish is important, the metrics is very important. The number of syllables, if you see Cien Años de Soledad, Cien Años de Soledad, it's 8 syllables. And El Olvido Que Seremos is also 8, it's important. And okay.
There's a rhythm, there's a metric. Yeah.
I suppose in English the importance is rhythm and tonic, tonic vowels, etc. But the poem, as I was saying, that you believe the word in the words of your parents. So it was signed by J.L.B. So it is clear for a Latin American, it is very clear that it's Jorge Luis Borges. So my father's, in some ways, in my father's handwriting, it was written that it was written by Borges.
But
so I
say,
believed.
But he has to say here that your father was a very good reader. So he was a voracious reader. He read a lot of books. And he will know how Borges.
He loved poetry.
Yeah,
he loved poetry and he loved Borges.
Borges, yeah.
So I believe that. But in fact, the poem was not and is not in Borges' opera Omnia, Borges' books. In Borges' complete poetry.
Borges,
And I have discussed with the widow, with Maria Kodama, many times about the poem, and she insists that the poem is not by Borges. And I made a very detailed research that Matthew then translated into English in a version that is shorter. It's shorter because for a magazine it was too much. But should I spoil that story?
No, but it's not a story. But suffice to say that it's a fascinating story.
Well,
that took you to several cities, took you to Buenos Aires.
There is a poet in Colombia, his name is Harold Alvarado Tenorio. And when the book was published and the book was well received, that is always very suspicious. And he said, "You liar! You stupid man! You are trying to put your name side by side with Borges' name just to sell books, and you invented the story of the poem. And that is a big lie because I wrote the poem."
Let's leave it like that. Let's leave it like that. Let's leave it like that for people to find out what happened and how you have to do it differently.
The problem was that he wrote the poem.
Supposedly he was the author of the poem.
He wrote the poem 5 years after my father had the poem in his pocket.
Yes, indeed. Just before we open the questions to the people, I'm going to move a little bit on books and you as a writer. You are a man of letters, as we say. You are a very well-known figure in Colombia. You publish in magazines, in newspapers. There's a deep skepticism throughout your book, and there's a deep skepticism in all of your books. Anybody who has read your novels sense that dry humor, skepticism, this almost agnostic thing. I wanted to ask you about the role of the intellectuals in a country like Colombia. How do you see it? Do you see that they really have a purpose? Do you see that the impact they might have in society is limited? I got the impression that you think that, yes, intellectuals exist, it's fine that they exist, but the actual impact that they have in their societies, particularly in countries like Colombia or Mexico, perhaps, is not that great. Although we intellectuals or intellectuals might think that it is, but in fact it's not. Is that your point of view, Hector?
I think that lately
we are useless totally useless. Lately it's much more important to have a Twitter account and tell lies about Brexit, tell lies about Trump, tell lies about everything, and you will convince people. I don't know. It's in the referendum about the peace process.
Indeed.
All the what you call intellectuals, we were in favor of that. We wrote about that in favor, and we lose. For a small amount, a small percentage, yeah, as Brexit here, yeah, as Trump in America, as Bolsonaro, everything, yeah, is that way. So we are really useless. Yeah. I open a Twitter account trying to do something, but it's also useless. So I'm getting very old and tired.
No, I agree with you. I mean, what you're saying, and your historical coincidence, the day when Brexit was voted in this country was the same day when the peace process in Colombia was approved. So there's a parallel between Brexit and the peace process in Colombia. When Brexit was the same week, very, very close to each other, when Brexit happening and the peace process in Colombia, the peace
Colombia is also a globalized country.
Yes, a globalized country too. We are part of the world. Yes. Just a final question. In terms of the style, you're Spanish. I mean, in the Spanish that you write, you have a Colombian Spanish, but a very refined, nice Castilian, so to speak. And people talk about writers finding their own voice. Do you see yourself as a Colombian writer? You returned to Colombia because you needed that language of childhood in order to start to write books seriously. Mm-hmm. Do you see yourself as a Colombian writer, or do you see yourself as a Latin American or Spanish-speaking writer? It's one of those impossible questions, probably.
Well, I think English and Spanish are very strong languages. Mm-hmm. Imperial languages are very strong because they conquered different countries, different cultures, different vegetables, animals, everything. So these languages are so strong, probably because of that. Yeah? There are so many people of all races, all
creeds,
So I don't speak Spanish. Spanish is speaks for me. Spanish is very strong. That's what I speak very well Italian.
Yeah.
But Italian doesn't speak in me.
Okay.
Strong languages are so. I don't know if it's the same with Dutch or with smaller languages, but these languages, there is a poet in Catalonia, Joan Margarit, who writes both in Catalan and in Spanish, and he, one day, discussing, he's a nationalist, I am not, he's a nationalist, he was talking about the how heavy is the Spanish, for them especially, how heavy is the Spanish.
Yeah.
I try to write not in a language that is called costumbrista, that is vernacular Spanish totally, but I use the words we normally use at home. I even made a translation recently of Candide, and I tried to put it in Colombian Spanish, but not because I'm a nationalist. I'm not. I think I was born there, as everybody, everywhere by chance. But it's a chance I cannot refuse.
I got a final question. And the final question is this. And it's also almost an unavoidable question, too. And it's to do with literature and the tradition of literature, particularly in Latin America. I am biased. I think that Latin America in the 20th century produced the best literature in the world, the most sophisticated. And obviously the boom, and we're talking about Borges, global writer now. You belong to a generation of the post-boom writers. And one of the stereotypes that people have about Latin America is everybody writes like García Márquez. Everything is magic realism. A style copy by even writers here like Salman Rushdie too. But are you aware that you are very much away from that? You are not at all magic realism. You are kind of sort of testimonial realist writer. Are you aware of being part
of that tradition of responding to something before you. In other words, if I put it in less convoluted way, what is your relationship with writers like Márquez, Vargas Llosa, etc., seeing that those big writers from the past and the boom generation?
When I met García Márquez in Cuba, long time ago, and I put it in my journal that it will be published, all those days, I love him very much. I love his writing. I love almost all of his books. But when I met him, he has published a book that I didn't like. And I had published Noticia de un Secuestro. And news about a kidnapping. And the week before I met him, I published in El Espectador a very bad
review.
A review of that. That was terrible. But I was even mentioning that there were some orthography mistakes.
Oh my goodness!
So, and he was furious in some ways. And he said, after we were drinking with more people, he said, the problem with Colombian critics is we don't have real critics. We only have preview correctors.
Proofreaders.
Don't hear this, Hector. The critics in Colombia are only proofreaders. And with this irony, it was a good lecture. But in some ways, the history of our language is also the Spanish history. So our classics are also Cervantes, Lope de Vega, Quevedo. But García Márquez wrote in kind of an epics of Latin America. So when I saw him, when I heard him talking, not that time, but after that, I also worked for his magazine, Cambio, as a columnist. And he was a genius with words. Even when he lose his memory, he was saying all the time beautiful things. Yeah. I remember once he was in his house in Cartagena, and he had a kind of a beginning of Alzheimer's or something, without memory. And someone came in, and he said, he saw that man, and he said, "I don't know who you are, but I know that I love you." And he was all the time saying beautiful, beautiful things with language. He had this, he was not an intellectual. He was not.
He wasn't. Absolutely.
He didn't pretend to be an intellectual. He had this gift of constructing. I don't know beautiful sentences.
Absolutely. Anybody who knows Spanish language will say that Márquez was the Cervantes of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. His novel 100 Years of Solitude was published in 1967, and in 3 years was a classic. Everybody has read that book. Yeah. It was an instant classic, and a difficult book, but an instant classic. And in Latin America, was a book nowadays that most people speak about and have read it, actually. Mm-hmm. But there you are. With that note, we are going to finish the conversation. I'm going to open to the public. Any questions that you have for Hector, feel free. And I've been told that there will be a wine reception after the Q&A session. So please feel free to ask Hector. You want to? I don't know. Anybody? Any hands?
Okay, yes.
Hi.
Hola. One big question. I'm going to tell you an anecdote. I was living, I'm a journalist, and I was in West Africa in 2001, something like that. And I had the big idea to create a book group in Spanish. Mm-hmm. Except that you couldn't find books in Spanish at all.
Okay.
So I found one copy of recetas.
Tratado culinario para mujeres tristes.
I don't know English.
Recipes for sad women, I think, has been translated.
Yes. And it was the only opportunity to read a book, so we started. We spent a whole month dividing page by page. And at some point, I thought you hated women.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. And that was a lot of in the discussion was that you didn't like me. And then when I read about you and your family, I said, no, it's the opposite. You like women and you were surrounded by women all the time, yes? So, can you... Sorry, it's just...
Alexandra, do I hate
you? That's his wife.
At that point, we didn't have the opportunity to read many books in Spanish. All some of it. And also, to be honest, it was a big discovery. And being able to read it, not just read it, but almost like a Bible, read it page by page. Yeah. We have to read it for a whole month, and the book is not so big.
It is a curious book, isn't it, Hector? I mean, it was one of those experimental phases, because it is a book which has recipes, but also kind of embedded recipes which are obviously completely nonsensical,
yes.
And then real ones. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that book.
I was ill, and I was reading Ars Amandi, the classical Roman... El Arte de Amar, de Ovidio. And I read it in a translation that was also in verses of 11 and 7 syllables. So I began to write in that style. And I wrote the first version, it was in poetry, it was in verses. But I used things that my friends, my sisters, many women told me. So it is not exactly my voice. If you got the impression of that I hate women, maybe women hate women. It was a divertimento. Nobody wanted to publish the book. I sent the book to 7 publishers, and they say no. So my
no, you hate women, you know.
My wife published it first time, with her own money. Yes.
Any other questions?
Yeah, and now that you talk about publishing and women, I'm always struck by the fact that they're women writers, Colombians, but they're not translated abroad, and there are very few translations into English by women.
Yes.
And also, I'm struck by the fact that the whole complication of the publishing houses. It seems to be against writers that want to publish, particularly writers of the frontera, women or people that live abroad, like many Colombians around the world now, that are, I could say, I include myself into with them, writers abroad that have to link the cultures they've been living between Colombia and all the around the world. So what do you think about...
Yes, it's true, it's more difficult. I organize a prize in Colombia, the Biblioteca Prize of Narrative, and we usually receive 110 books every year. It's a prize for published books, and only 11 or 10 books, 10%, are written by women. So it's difficult also in the beginning. Because of that, we, with Alexandra, who's here, we opened a new small publishing house 3 years ago. The first book was written by a woman. This prize was Pilar Quintana won the prize some years ago, and with La Perra, the bitch that will be published by World Editions, I think this year or next year. Next year. So I think you have to do a little bit of affirmative action with that. There are many women in the jury usually, and if we can, with that 11 or 10% books written by women, if they are good, we put them in the short list. But we cannot do, if the books are not great, we cannot do that. And I know it's difficult. The reasons, there are many reasons for that. Historical, cultural. Here is my friend Fatima Bhutto, who is non-man. This book is non-fiction. And She's publishing.
What's the name of your publishing house in Colombia?
Angosta Editores.
Angosta Editores. Okay. Next. More questions. Ooh, okay. Let's do these three questions here.
I'd like to ask you about your forthcoming projects and whether you're planning a poetry book.
I would publish my 20 years of journals in November. It was difficult, but I had a scholarship in Holland 3 years ago, and I finished a book I didn't like. So I'm not publishing it. The title was Perhaps the Descent. And I was almost desperate, and talking with the editor about this, not having a book, we talk about the notebooks and we will publish that. I have ideas, I have new projects, but usually I write three books and two of them fail and then I publish one.
Yes. And your journals are going to be published in Colombia or where?
Before, yeah, the first edition is in Colombia in November, in Spain next March.
Okay.
And poetry. I wrote one book of poetry. Yes. I began writing poetry when I was very young, when I was 13. And I have a very close friend, my best friend, Daniel. My daughter is called Daniela because of this friend. My friend Daniel, when he was 16, he committed suicide. And I decided, okay, poetry is too dangerous. I'm not going to write more poetry because of that. Because we were writing poems all the time, so talking about suicide. But I thought he was not serious talking about it. And he was serious.
Is there a particular book, or maybe a few books, about Colombia, written by a Colombian or a non-Colombian, that you really like?
About Colombia from a sociological, historical point of view, or something.
There are many,
but for example, Jorge Orlando Melo, who's a very good historian, published 1 year ago a very short history of Colombia that I think is brilliant. There is a woman, Piedad Bonet, who wrote
very known here.
Beautiful poems and beautiful books, not about Colombia, but are in Colombia. And I like very much Santiago Gamboa, Juan Gabriel Vázquez, many writers.
Any other questions?
Yes, my question is more about the actual process of writing this novel. I haven't read it, and this friend of mine invited me to come along, and I'm seriously going to read it in time. How did you know when you had actually finished the novel? It is such an intimate and such a testament to your father. How did you know that the process of writing was over?
Mm-hmm. I was editing my journals this morning because I have to send the last copy, and in the last pages I was in a farm. I moved to the countryside to finish the book, and the book was published in November. It was April, and I wrote in the journal, "This is a total failure. This is a total failure. This book is terrible. I don't know what I am going to do with it." And the day after, I was very happy. I wrote 10 pages that are beautiful. I'm so happy. And I was listening to Brahms. And yes, it's like birds, and Brahms are beautiful. And you don't know. You really don't know. You have to finish. You have to finish at some point. You have to put the last.
I think Borges said you have to publish in order to stop editing.
yes. But sometimes I also realize after the book is published that I should probably work much more on the book. I published because I received very bad reception of a novel, Fragmentos de Amor Furtivo. And I liked the book, but I was very angry with the reviews.
And I saw there was a prize in Spain, so I decided I will win this prize. And I wrote this book, Basura, Trash, in 3 months. And I won the prize, but I'm not...
That's a revenge. Okay, the
but I know I wrote it. If I had 1 year working, the book could be very beautiful. And you did with will publish it. But I
What prize did you win?
It was a prize of Premio Casa de América de Literatura Innovadora in Madrid.
Big one.
Yes, it was.
Big one. It was.
Villa Matas and Bolaño were in the jury. Whoa. Yes, it was nice. But the book is. Me precipité a terminar. How do you say
that? It was. Yes. I rushed to finish it. Yeah. Yes. Two more questions. Three more questions.
No question. Sorry. It was. Comment.
Okay.
Because you say the poetry is dangerous, and we finish with this. No, I said poetry is whatever the poet and whatever this thing you are writing poetry. Because we are using poetry here as healing of the wounds from the conflict in Colombia. Yeah. And we are writing books. Yeah. And we are happy with this, and you have to come writing poetry.
No, in fact, I wrote poetry. And I still write poetry. And in fact, there is a poem I wrote in Caracas in the year 2001 that is this book in 2 pages. It's called Memento, and it's the story of my father in a poem. And usually I write a poem and then a novel. Also, The Farm was a poem. So it's... But this... Sometimes you feel that you can put in a few words a lot of information, a lot of substance, and sometimes not.
But that's quite interesting, Hector. You're talking about poetry as a condensed idea, of a posterior novel.
Yes, yeah,
totally. Incredible, yeah, it's very nice. Two more questions.
It's a little bit about finding the voice. As you mentioned, I also had this book in a reading club in the Cervantes Grupo de Lectura. And when I started reading, I was thinking, how lucky Hector was. He had such a wonderful dad. And as I was reading at the beginning, I was thinking, oh, this is going to be too much. I mean, like the idea of having this fabulous father, because I didn't know your personal story, so I was just, you know, going for it. But then, obviously, you realize that the book is more than that idealized figure. But I don't know if you were aware that there was that sort of risk of having that, because it's so strong, obviously, everything that you were talking about, your dad is very personal, it's very... I mean, you go from these beautiful things to then having to describe moments that are very difficult. So how did you play with finding that voice of not being too idealized, but also not being very harsh, and still leave the reader, like in my case, with very satisfied with the novel? I mean, I really, really enjoyed the novel.
Yes, I think it took me those years to find that voice, because in the beginning, when I tried to write about that, I was crying all the time.
I cry a lot.
But then when I finally I wrote the book, I didn't cry. I was much more calm.
Yes.
And after the book, I am totally calm.
Yes.
the book. That's why also it's not a literary work for me. It was. I forget many things, but I couldn't forget that. When I wrote the book, I felt the relief that I can't forget. No problem. Now I can't forget.
Yeah.
There is the book that will speak to me.
And that's the irony, isn't it? Now you can't forget, but now you are making unforgettable the figure of your father. And in certain ways, what I was saying at the beginning, it's a fascinating novel. It works on so many levels. The testimonial life of,
of Hector, but also of Colombia and Colombian society and Medellin, that which is a fantastic city which everybody should visit because it's a glorious city in Colombia. So it was on so many levels. But you have succeeded on preserving the memory of your father. I think you have succeeded on that. And I think that the success of the book will prove even greater in the future. I'm convinced about that.
We will fail, we will die.
Well, we will fail and we will die, yes. The skeptic there. A last question over there.
Thank you. You left Colombia with the son, and it was a país de mierda. There's still a lot of turmoil in the country, and you're wondering, how did you reconcile with Colombia? Have you reconciled at all?
It's like finishing the book. Some days I hate the country. Some days I really want to leave. I want to leave. I want to live in Madrid, in London, anywhere but Colombia. And some other days, I feel maybe there is a redemption, maybe we can work hard for a new country. I don't know. It depends. Today, I'm not reading the papers while I'm in Europe, so I'm more optimistic.
Yes. Well, on that happy optimistic note, please put your hands together for Hector.
Artefacto, un espacio radial sobre la cultura de nuestros días, desde una mirada hispanoamericana.
Literatura,
arte,
cine,
teatro,
filosofía.
Sesenta minutos de crítica cultural para una gran minoría. Radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.